Welcome back to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm your host, Graham Richmond, and I'm joined today by Alex Brown, a very frequent guest on the podcast. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you very much for having me again, Graham.
And today we're going to talk about the waitlist. We've actually done a podcast about the waitlist before, but we're going to delve a little deeper specifically into like what can you do now if you've been waitlisted in round one and are, you know, on pins and needles as we get closer to kind of round two decisions. So we're going to unpack that, give you some tips and help people take action, basically. I did want to say before we get started that we've now recorded over 30 episodes of the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast, and we're just grateful to all of you who tune in on a regular basis. This podcast has far exceeded all of our expectations. We're just thrilled with the number of listeners we have. We do want you to rate and review the podcast. In fact, if you write a review, shoot us an email at info@clearadmit.com, and we will actually read your review over the over the airwaves on our next podcast. So we really would love to get some reviews. That helps people learn about this podcast and just spreads the word. So, and again, we're available on, you know, Google Play, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, etc. So tune us in. Thanks for listening. Let's get started with today's episode. So, Alex, some quick basics. So, like, what is the waitlist? Like, why on earth do schools have a waitlist? You know, they promise candidates a decision on a certain date, and then they give them a waitlist, which isn't really a decision, I guess. So tell me a little bit about, like, what is this waitlist thing, and why do schools do it?
Sure. And I think what I'll speak to specifically is the waitlist for the round one candidates going into round two. So schools, when they're making decisions for round one, they haven't yet seen the round two and round three pools of candidates. So they're kind of making decisions half blind to the overall population of the candidates applying for the upcoming season. So in order to make sure that they don't over-admit in round one, which is not a good thing for schools, they are potentially actually going to under-admit and place a number of candidates, as we know, on the wait list. They under-admit because they don't want to have to offer deferrals if they've got too big a class coming in, right? But what they can do is offer admissions decisions to candidates they placed on the wait list in round one and obviously in round two and so forth. The nice thing is what we see typically year on year is the successful candidates off the wait list is more likely going to happen from round one to round two. So this upcoming couple of weeks when decisions for round two come out, we should see a number of people getting admitted off the waitlist. So that's very good. Finally, I'd categorize those placed on the waitlist into three sort of broad buckets. Candidates that maybe didn't express real good commitment to the school that they're applying to, lack of knowledge of the school they're applying to, and so forth, which makes the school suspicious that perhaps they're not a number one choice. So that's kind of yield maintenance on the school side, but it does occur for a number of schools. Secondly, it could possibly be that you are a candidate that's just on the cusp, on the bubble, on the edge, or whatever the right term is. And in any given year, you'd be a strong candidate in the program, but you just didn't quite make the cut in that, like I say, when they're under-admitting a little bit in round one. Or you could be sort of in a similar fashion, you could be a candidate that's sort of from quite a popular profile. So again, you've been placed on the bubble a little bit. And then finally, there might be real strength in your candidacy, but one flaw. Or two flaws, but most likely one flaw in this case, the school would really like you to take action about to try to then build up your profile to make you admissible going into round two or even round three in this case. So that's how I would sort of present the reasons for the waitlist at this point and the types of candidates that are placed on the waitlist, Graham.
So one thing I should mention just for our listeners is that Alex worked in admissions, as many of you know, at the Wharton School. I think it was for more than 7 years as a kind of senior associate director. And I presume you had some exposure to the waitlist as you were in that role. I think one thing that I wanted to kind of hear from you about is what are the differences in the way schools handle this? So I mean, I agree. It sounds like, you know, some schools waitlist people, I think all schools waitlist people for different reasons. Like, as you said, it could be a flaw in the candidacy. It could be the candidate doesn't seem like they're interested in your school and you don't want to admit someone who maybe is certainly not going to show up. Or it could be that you're just kind of on the cusp, overrepresented, et cetera. But then after that, after the waitlist decision happens, schools handle it differently. So do you want to just speak to that briefly here?
Sure. I mean, hopefully those folks that have been placed on the waitlist in round one understand this to this point. But schools will have different rules in terms of how to react and respond to the waitlist. I think pretty much every school asks you, do you want to be on the waitlist? So there is a point there where you can drop off the waitlist. And I would suggest just drop off if you've been admitted by your number one school and you're getting waitlisted by another school. If you've no plan to enrol, make it easier for other candidates by dropping off yourself, right? So that just makes everybody happier. And it does happen, you know, you might get admitted at Harvard and you might be waitlisted at Chicago. Don't be surprised. This sort of stuff does happen. Just get off the Chicago waitlist because you're going to go to Harvard, right? In that case, most likely, I mean, there might be some circumstance where you want to go to Chicago. But nevertheless, in the first instance, pretty much every school asks you to opt into the waitlist. So you should have done that to this point. Some schools, and I would say actually the majority of schools, then ask you to follow up in a variety of fashions. A few schools ask you not to follow up, right? So maybe the very top schools, I think Harvard's one of them, maybe Wharton is still one of them. In those cases, it becomes tricky because I will argue that some people still do follow up, so they're breaking the rules, and sometimes they're rewarded for that behaviour, i.e. they get admitted. So in the case of those types of schools, it is a bit of a grey area. I'd say if you have a substantial change, like a job promotion or a significantly higher test score or something, then send it into the school. The other thing about those schools is if someone else follows up for you, you could argue you're still within the rules because you didn't follow up, but maybe the guy that interviewed you, guy being gender neutral, maybe they followed up. Maybe an alum that you work with followed up because you had a conversation with that alum. She was keen to understand your progress in the admissions at the school that she's a big advocate for. And you tell her, you know, I was waitlisted, and she's a little bit, you know, maybe she just then wants to follow up and assure the school that she believes you would be a great candidate, right? So you don't even have to necessarily have pushed the alum. They may follow up. That would be a really good thing. There may be others following up for you. And I would say for the majority of schools, however, they ask you to follow up. And in that case, having a third party follow up for you, an alum, a student, an interviewer, and so forth, is obviously a good thing. But it also, you want to take a real good introspective look at your candidacy, identify which of the three buckets you land in, i.e. was it a commitment issue? Is there a flaw in your candidacy where everything else is strong that you can fill out? Or are you just simply on the bubble, and really try to understand that and then follow up accordingly and be proactive so that you maximize your chance of getting a positive decision going into round two, because that is the most likely time you will come off the wait list.
Right. So when we think about the different things that people can do, I'll let you elaborate, but, you know, in my mind, obviously, they really range. You kind of touched on the idea of improving a test score or visiting a campus, submitting information about a promotion at work, having what we would call a letter of support come in, unsolicited letter of support, as we would call it, where a member of the school's community, be it a professor, a student, an alum who knows you, is kind of writing something on your behalf, often unbeknownst to you, or at least you want it to seem that way. So there are different things that you can do. Here we are now, it's, you know, we're recording this, it's kind of, we're a couple weeks away from the beginning of round two decisions. I think most schools are still in committee and will be for the next couple of weeks. So there's still some time left. And so if I'm listening to this podcast, Alex, and I'm on the wait list at my dream school, what could I do now to really improve my chances of coming off the list in round two here?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. Obviously, this is a very timely matter at this point. So retaking a standardized test that you haven't booked is probably not going to happen at this point. Yeah. But hopefully, if and when you are put on the wait list and your test score is below the average for the school, you recognize that's a potential weakness. You might have already remedied that to this point. So that would be a good thing. I think everybody that's on the wait list that wants to get off the wait list at a certain school can address the commitment issue, even if you think you did a good job of it in your application. You want to make sure that the school that's waitlisted you recognizes why the school is your number one choice. And the key to that is why. Don't just tell the school that they're your top choice, but back it up with two or three compelling reasons that they're your top choice based on your own personal circumstances and your professional circumstances and goals. Because it might not be obvious to them. There might be a geographic constraint that you face when applying to business schools. So your number one school happens to be in a less popular geographic location, but you are passionate about going to that particular school relative to some schools that may be more highly ranked, but out of your region, and schools that, quite frankly, you wouldn't relocate to, right? So make sure that you address the commitment issue. That is fundamental to getting off the wait list, for every candidate.
Yeah, and if I could interject there, I mean, one thing that I think about when it comes to writing that kind of a letter to the committee to just, you know, remind them that I'm still here and I'm really committed. And, you know, essentially you're kind of conveying a, if you accept me, if I come off the wait list, here's my check practically. You know, you're like, I'm coming, right? So there's that. But I think that those letters can be impactful if they reference specific steps that you've taken. So maybe you went to campus, maybe you attended the school. You know, a lot of these schools have alumni clubs in your city, and they, maybe there was a guest speaker or an event, and you kind of, you know, went and attended that and got a chance to speak with a number of alums, or, you know, whatever it might be, research you've done or communications you've had with a professor, or just even reading about, you know, specific classes or things, just demonstrating to the school that since your last communication, like since they've waitlisted you, you've continued to be passionate and actually even dig deeper and learn more about the school, and are, you're sort of almost more convinced than you were at the outset that this is the place for you based on all the steps that you've taken and the research you've conducted. So yeah, I think that can be very, very powerful.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think if you've been placed on the wait list and you hadn't visited the school prior to your application, to the extent that you're truly committed to wanting to go to that school, a campus visit that's reasonable in terms of you're not on the moon somewhere and you absolutely can't get to the campus, right? But if it's reasonable for you to get to the campus over the course of the month or two that you're on the wait list, you absolutely need to do that. And then sort of express your experience, the campus visit, in that sort of letter that really supports your commitment to attending the school. I think that is super important.
Okay, so we have a letter that you could write that sort of communicates your commitment. What are some of the other things people might do?
Obviously, writing a follow-up letter at this point in the waitlist process is simply super important, right? So we're 1 or 2 weeks away from these final decisions to be conveyed. So you're sort of basically signing off on your endeavor to get off the waitlist at this point. So that's very good. If you're simply on the bubble in terms of a candidate and you weren't quite admitted, you might want to reread your application and try to maybe sort of identify points that might not have been conveyed as effectively as perhaps in retrospect you think they could have been conveyed, and add some of that material back into this follow-up letter. So it might be that you've enjoyed a promotion since, or something positive has occurred since you submitted your application to this point now, that you can convey progress and growth in this sort of waitlist follow-up communication. So I think for those that are on the bubble and on the cusp, that can really be helpful. For those that there were gaps in your application where everything else is super strong, right? You're not going to be put on the waitlist if there are gaps in your application and everything else is sort of on the mark. They're just going to let you go. But if you've got a really strong profile, real interesting goals, maybe different type of work experience that you can bring to the community, but maybe your test score was slightly weaker, hopefully you've made the step to address that test score. If not, to this point, you still do the follow-up, reaffirm your commitment to the school, any sort of progress you've made, and then you tell them you've signed up for the test and it happens to be now after the round two deadline because you're a little bit late, but you're potentially keeping yourself in the running on the wait list to be then reconsidered again for round three. What you don't want is to be eliminated off the wait list at round two. So you could still come off the wait list in round three, but you've got to show something to the committee to keep you in the running. Because again, the committee now has more information on its pool, on its candidates, rounds one and round two. That's the majority of candidates totally. Well, for Harvard, it's everybody because they nixed the round three this year. But you've got to do something to keep yourself in the running if it is your number one school.
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, I think there probably are a number of round one waitlisters who realize they have a weakness. Maybe it's a GPA or a GMAT or something, you know, in their candidacy. And for one reason or another, they may not all have gone out and addressed this matter. And so I think your advice there about, hey, you know what, own it, write a note and indicate that it is in the works. You know, if you're taking the GMAT on April 1st, like let the school know, because at minimum, it might keep you on the wait list and not result in you just getting dropped, like you said. So for people with a low GPA or something, that could be as simple as kind of indicating, hey, look, here's my proof of registration with this kind of online coursework that I'm taking this spring. The courses will wrap, you know, by May 1st, and I'll be sending the transcripts and grades there to show you that, you know, I'm prepared. Or maybe you're a poet who doesn't have a lot of quantitative experience, or you're taking some classes. Keeping the committee abreast of this stuff is important because, as I said, you don't want to get dropped off the list just because they think, you know, oh, here were these weaknesses and this candidate hasn't done anything, right? So again, your optimal path would have been to take care of this stuff when you first found out you were waitlisted and have it all nicely lined up and ready to go in time for them to admit you in the second round when there are more spots available, because it does get a little dicier the longer you wait. But, you know, that is what it is. So I guess one other thing I wanted to ask you, so it sounds like, you know, so far we've said, okay, a letter expressing your commitment and interest in the program, maybe it's a letter that also addresses some new things that have happened in your candidacy, if there were holes or things that you didn't think you shined in. Maybe it's a letter that expresses very specific things that you did, like I took the GMAT again and achieved this score, or I'm slated to take the test as we just discussed. But then there's also this third idea that I thought I heard you express earlier, which is, what about communicating with, you know, the person that interviewed you, if you had an admissions interview, or others who you've kind of come into contact with over the course of your applying to the school? Obviously not the admissions officers, but, you know, if you interviewed with an alum or a current student, or you met current students or faculty over the course of your research, is there something that you were alluding to that we might want candidates to do with them, even at this late hour?
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense. The most important people in this process, other than yourself, maybe alums that you work with, and maybe because of those alums is why you're applying to the school, right? So you're applying to the school because you're impressed with alums that have been from that school and so on and so forth. That type of person may have some kind of vested interest in your success in the application process, may be keen to see you be successful in the application process. So for that type of person, and it could also be current students, right? So it might be colleagues that you worked with that are now in the school, right? Or friends and so forth from your undergrad that are now in the school, but you've maintained relationships with them and they've sort of allowed you to really understand the school and that's why you're applying. Those types of people, students and alums that you have a relationship with, should be alerted by you that you've been placed on the waitlist, right? And so you want to keep them abreast with your situation. If they're passionate about you and your candidacy, they may well then feel it's, you know, their obligation, I suppose, to submit some kind of letter to support your candidacy as you pursue the waitlist. So I think that's fair game, regardless of the school you're applying to. And I think it's very valuable because the schools themselves want to, you know, alums and current students are part of their constituency, right? So they want to make sure that they keep their students and alums happy, and they want to make sure they're doing right by them. And it doesn't guarantee anything. I mean, there might be something in admissions that they've seen about you that you're just not going to get admitted, although I'm not sure why they put you on the waitlist in the first place if that was the case. But if you're having support from alums and students in your file, I think that's good. And again, I don't think a letter that just says, I can't believe you waitlisted Jennifer Smith, you know, I'm an alum of the program, I've contributed to the program and so on and so forth, can you please change this decision? That's not going to be helpful. The alum letter that's going to be helpful is going to be very gracious. So thank you very much for considering Jennifer Smith as she continues in the admissions process, and then backs it up with a couple of substantial reasons why she or he thinks Jennifer Smith is a great candidate for the school that they truly enjoyed during their time at the school, or again, if they're a current student, that they're currently enjoying. So it needs to be a substantial letter of support, not a flippant sort of, I can't believe, you know, admissions director, you've messed up here, get this person admitted straight away, right? So that just won't work. And it might be, you know, when you interviewed with an alum or a student that you had a particular rapport and you followed up. Since then, you thanked them for the interview and they got back to you and were excited about the interview and so forth. If that's the case, then follow up with that interviewer and make sure they're aware that you were placed on the wait list without, you know, pushing them to follow up. But they may then decide that to follow up in the same sort of circumstance. You don't want to do that with an ADCOM member, right? So, you know, if I interviewed you whilst I was at war and you placed on the waitlist, I'm going to know that, or, you know, I'm not very good at my job. So, but for students that interview you that might not be as closely tied to the process, and alums for sure, follow up if you've built a relationship with them. I think that's standard and pretty decent advice for the waitlist.
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts just to add to that. So the first is that a lot of these folks, whether it's, you know, maybe it's someone who's very senior at your firm, who's a graduate of the program in question and really likes you and is wants you to go, you know, is really supportive. Sometimes they're busy, right? And so I've often heard candidates say, yeah, I told my, you know, colleague at work who's an alum, and that if they were to write a note that could be helpful. And the alum says, oh, I'm busy. Give me the phone number of the admissions director. I'll just give her a call, you know, and then you get into that awkward phone call, which follows more or less what you said, which is like, hey, you got to get, you know, Jen Smith in, you know, what's going on here? You know, then that does not work. In fact, any kind of phone communication is not advised. You don't want to put the director of admissions or any of the committee members on the spot. And you want to show that you, the senior, you know, business executive, whatever, who's an alum, have taken the time to write a letter and to, as you say, elaborate on why is this person great. And I actually still can recall when I was in admissions over at Wharton, I can still recall reading a letter. It was a letter of support. It actually came from a current student who had, I think it was a college or high school friend who had applied and was on the wait list. And, you know, they talked about how they knew for a fact that if this person were to be accepted, they were coming. So that was one, they put one issue to rest, right? Then they also mentioned that that person had come to the campus, I guess, part of their interview process or whatever, and had ended up spending the night and hanging out on campus for a couple of days. And that they had seen their friend interact with their study group, with, you know, other people in the kind of Wharton community. And, you know, they just wrote this like glowing letter that basically said, look, I know this candidate and I know this school and the two couldn't be better for one another. You know, it was like, it was just, you know, a really great, and it was backed up with examples. You know, obviously the student knew the candidate. And it was just, yeah, really, they backed it up. And I think that's important, because a short form letter that says, I understand you've waitlisted, you know, Jen Smith, please admit her, I'm an alum, I think she'd be great. Like, that's just not going to cut it. And it's going to be mostly insulting to the admissions team. So yeah, so you have to tread carefully here. And I think, as you correctly point out, you can't go to your interviewer or someone you met in the admissions process and say, put in a word. You just want to update them, you know, and then it's up to them to sort of decide that they're going to, you know, obviously they might write you back and say, oh my gosh, you know, I'm sorry to hear this. I really hope you get it off the wait list. Let me know if there's anything I can do. At which point you might say, well, I have heard that in some instances, if a letter comes in from a third party that supports my candidacy, that could be helpful. So if you feel comfortable and strongly enough about it, you know, writing a letter to the admissions committee sometimes helps, you know. So it's a delicate process. And the one thing I did want to ask you is, so how many of these letters do I want to have? Do I want 10 of them, 5, 1? What's the rule here? Because I think there are some rules, right?
Yeah, I mean, you don't want a lot, because it seems then you've been deliberate, you're campaigning, it's not particularly appropriate, and you're just creating more work for the ADCOM. If you had one or two substantial pieces from, you know, supporters, I think that's fantastic. But you can overdo it, which can backfire. And you do raise a very good point that I didn't address, is in that sort of follow-up, if it is an alum and a student, and they do know you well, they can also reaffirm your commitment to coming to the school, because you've had several conversations with said candidate and they've expressed exactly to you why. Again, it's why this is the best choice for them, not just that it is the best choice. So, yeah, one or two is fantastic. And they want to be a page and a half of content. They don't want to be, you know, 5 pages long. But again, they want to be 2 or 3 paragraphs, because there needs to be substance in these follow-up communications.
Okay. So it sounds like getting a letter in that you write about your commitment, trying to make sure you've addressed whatever might have been weaknesses, and then potentially sourcing a letter of support from someone that you know who's ideally an alum or member of the school community in some way. those are all things that could happen here kind of at the 11th hour as you're awaiting the committee's decision on round two candidates. And again, they're going to take all those round one waitlisters and throw them into the round two pool, essentially. So those are things we could do. I did want to ask, some candidates who are waiting are also faced or have recently been faced or, you know, are still kind of ongoingly kind of trying to decide what to do with a letter of acceptance that they may have gotten from other schools, right? So a lot of schools that may have admitted a candidate in round one have deposit deadlines, often, you know, for $1,000 or even in some cases, several thousand dollars. What do you do? You know, you obviously, do you deposit? Is that unfair to a school to deposit while you're on the wait list somewhere else? I just thought it might be good to kind of close with some advice there, because I think people are often confused.
Yeah, I don't think it's particularly unfair. Schools are taking a deposit, they're taking some money. They understand their yields from deposits as well as their yields from admits. So they factor in that some people will be deposit, yet will take another choice when that becomes available to them. So schools absolutely understand this behaviour. So what you do need to do, you know, a bird in the hand is worth whatever. You need to deposit where you have the choice for now, as you work the wait lists of the school that you truly want to attend come the fall, or your favourite option come the fall, because, you know, pragmatically, you might not get admitted off the wait list and you don't want to be left hanging, right? So schools absolutely understand that. I don't think there's any recourse at all.
Yeah, I've often felt like, you know, schools use wait lists, and so candidates sort of use wait lists themselves by, you know, depositing and then figuring out if they can get in somewhere else too. One last thing actually that you just reminded me of is, if I'm a candidate and I'm taking these steps and trying to get in off the wait list, but it ultimately falls short and I don't have other options, has this all been for naught? I mean, what does the school do? I mean, when you were at Wharton, you see someone who you've waitlisted, they hang on the list all, you know, all through the admissions cycle. They're providing you with additional information, but ultimately you don't have a spot for them. Should they bother to show up next year? Like, is there any benefit to kind of doing this stuff and then reapplying, or is it sort of like they should move on?
Yeah, I mean, certainly candidates that placed on the wait list, obviously they may choose to go to another school, right? So they disappear. But if they come back as a reapplicant and they sort of, you know, maybe their application's a bit sharper through the learning curve of the situation in the previous year, they've taken some steps to some growth and so on and so forth. One thing that they've demonstrated is commitment, which again is an issue that schools really try to understand, right? So typically reapplicants' admit rates are slightly higher than first-time applicants for most schools. There might be one or two exceptions to that. But typically the reapplicant rate is higher. And you would have to assume, and I've never seen the data, but to assume those that were actually waitlisted, that admit rate should be slightly higher than someone that was flat out denied and then reapplied. But there's absolutely a learning curve in this process. So when you come back a subsequent year to reapply, if you stayed on the waitlist to the end, I think your chances, as long as you have good execution on the application, you take care of any flaws, if it was an application that had maybe one flaw and everything else was strong, I think you should be in good shape. I would advise you, regardless of staying on the waitlist through the summer and so forth, is to reapply in the first round. There's this sort of idea that you need some separation and maybe reapply in round two to allow for further growth. I think that then puts you in a bit of jeopardy, because the other sort of side of the thinking is, if you knew that you wanted this school early in the process, you should be applying in round one regardless.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's good advice. I think, you know, we at some point could have an entirely separate podcast about that one category of waitlist, which is around, you know, commitment and schools kind of massaging their yields, because I think that's a really interesting subject. But I think our goal today was really to just help you, the listener, to sort of think through what's, you know, what's going to happen. And just from a timeline perspective, as you must know, a lot of the top schools are going to start issuing their round two admissions decisions in the middle of March. And it's going to run, you know, across the sort of top 20 or 30 schools or so. It's going to run for about 2 to 3 weeks, where different schools are offering up acceptances to the round two candidates. And again, if you're a round one waitlist, you are effectively have become a round two candidate. So and so as a result, a lot of these schools are, you know, they're on the road doing interviews, kind of wrapping up the interviewing process. And then they're going to be hunkered down in committee meetings for a couple of weeks as they sort of try to finalize what, you know, who they're going to admit. So there's a lot happening and there is some time, and we encourage people to, yeah, take the steps you can to improve your odds. And, you know, as Alex pointed out just earlier, even if it doesn't work out for you, there are some benefits to kind of expressing interest and being proactive about the wait list this year, because if you reapply next year, you're likely to be remembered, and they're going to know, as Alex said, that you're committed. So that's all. Those are all the questions that I had. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to share, any other tidbits of advice, Alex?
I don't think so. I think we covered it, because I do actually think it's a pretty straightforward sort of process. It's like, try to identify why you're put on the wait list in the first place, and then take whatever course of action is most appropriate. And you know, if you have potential cheerleaders in the process that can support you in that, whether it's an alum or one or two alums or students, that will be very helpful to you. But I do, you know, at the end of the day, I wish you the best of luck, and hopefully your waitlist decision goes favorably. If not, hopefully you're in a great school, because, you know, a lot of these top schools all provide great opportunities. So best of luck with your success going forward.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, Alex. And yeah, my sending my best wishes as well to anyone listening who's on a wait list. We know it's a tough process. I actually, I have personal experience having been on a wait list at a couple of schools back when I applied. So I know it's not fun, but it does work out in many instances. So keep at it and stay tuned, and hopefully you'll get some good news. And stay tuned to this podcast. We got a lot of great episodes coming up with some exciting external guests. I'm not going to reveal their names just yet, but we have some really good stuff on tap. So stay tuned, rate and review this podcast in iTunes, and we will see you next time on the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. Thanks again, Alex.
Thanks a lot, Graham.